In 2004, he was elected as a living national treasure. That might be something you didn't know about him. He was made an officer of the Order of Australia in 2009 and was awarded the Sydney Peace Prize in 2014. I'm sure he's probably been awarded many other things as well. And of course, I'm talking about the one and only Julian Burnside. Please welcome.
I would like to also follow in the traditional way and acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we meet on, but I would like to add it is worth remembering that our forebears took the land from them in what was undoubtedly a white invasion, and then to add insult to injury, we took their children from them, and we don't seem to be in any position to make amends for the damage that we caused them. Also, you mentioned Peter Dutton. I was really charmed to hear him say that both people are illiterate and illiterate in their own language. I don't know how he knew it in any language other than arithmetic. But maybe that says more about him than about them. And since we're talking about politicians, which is not one of my favourite subjects, I would like to acknowledge the immense contribution which Richard Wynne, who represents this area, has made at a local level to our attempts to see asylum seekers treated a little more decently. The courage thing is really good, but I sort of want to address the question, why should anyone care about this? You know, we really have got to a stage where you wonder, why do people care when people who stay involved in the issue for so long? And I think there's a number of reasons why we should care. The first is that the whole bipartisan policy in relation to asylum seekers, especially boat people, is based on dishonesty and hypocrisy. It is ridiculously expensive, it's intentionally cruel, and it's just not the way Australians are. And so they have to hide the facts from us. So, dishonesty and hypocrisy. It all started with Tampa, which I remember quite clearly because I was involved in Tampa litigation. Some people are not aware of this. You know, when the tank was a cargo ship, it was asked by the Australian government to go to the rescue of a bunch of people, Hazaras from Afghanistan, whose boat had fallen apart in the Indian Ocean. The tanker did what decent people do at sea. They went and rescued them, and then headed towards Christmas Island, because that was the next landfall on the route that the tanker was taking. But John Howard denied them the right to enter Australian territorial waters off Christmas Island. And here the captain of the tanker was stuck with a problem, because his ship was licensed for 50 people, had 47 crew, and 438 unintended passengers. So he defied the Australian government, sailed into Australian territorial waters. Howard sent out the SAS, who took command of the bridge at gunpoint, and then there was a standoff. Some of you will remember the photographs of this, of the Tampa, a few kilometres up. Howard then closed the airspace over Christmas Island, and there was an order in the military that there should be no humanising images of any of the people rescued by the Tampa. Because right from the start, he did not want us to see them as human beings. There's another theories of why I did that. In any event, the case started on a Friday night, around Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then the judge reserved his decision. And the decision of the trial judge in the Tampa case was handed down at 2:15 in the afternoon, Northern time, on the 11th of September 2001. Just think about it. 8 hours later, there was the attack on America, and all of a sudden, you didn't have terrorists anymore, only Muslim terrorists. You didn't have boat people anymore, only Muslim boat people. And Howard started calling them illegal. Now, those of you who were sort of alive and conscious in September 2001, you will remember the atmosphere. It was very weird. All of a sudden, you couldn't say anything that was vaguely friendly to anyone who might conceivably be a terrorist. Even if they're spending terrorism, they're probably terrorists, you know, that's the logic. And so, these who was the leader of the opposition at the time, didn't say anything in answer to Howard's illegal standing. And 2 months later, there's the election. The election which, in July of 2001, was very not finely balanced. There was real doubt about who was going to get in. But, of course, Howard came storming home on the slogan, "We will decide who comes to this country in circumstances if they come," which I wasn't even going to talk about this. Let's pick it up. "We will decide who comes to this country in circumstances in which they come." If he's talking about migration policy, that is absolutely right. Migration is a selfish transaction on both sides. The migrant wants to move, the country wants people with the migrant's particular set of skills, and so the migrant is allowed to come in. But it's different with refugees. Refugees have a right which we acknowledge in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a right to seek asylum in any country they can reach. And we were instrumental in preparing the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. And so we acknowledge right from the start that people are allowed to seek asylum. They're not illegal, they don't break any law, you all know that. But more than that, we have acknowledged their right to seek asylum. Now, Howard's aphorism can be interestingly tested with a domestic example. Like many of you, I'm sure, we get more visitors at home than is good for health. And I'm entitled to say, I will decide who comes to my house and the circumstances in which they come, and I don't want visitors until Thursday week. Right. So what if the next morning, a little kid runs to the door, knocks on the door and says, "Please help me, I'm being chased by a man with a big knife." I could say, "Come back on Thursday week," but I wouldn't. Because that's a different situation. What you would do is bring her in, sit her down, check her story. If it turns out that she's pulling your leg, you send her home. If it turns out that she's dead income, you protect her. That's the difference between migration and asylum seekers. Asylum seekers ought to be welcomed because we owe it to them as other human beings to offer them safety. They are not likely terrorists. Terrorists do not run away from terrorism. They are probably not extremists because they're running away from extremists. Now the other thing that Howard did, and this was picked up by Labour subsequently, was to talk about the drownings. And you'll be hearing a lot of that in the next week, because they picked up the asylum seeker thing as they repeat what they did in 2013. Let's outbid each other on how cruel we can be to a group of human beings. I wish the politicians would just give it a go sometime and maybe promise cruelty to animals. See where that gets them. But cruelty to human beings, it's a river. And so they're trying to outbid each other on that. The drownings argument is nonsense. The drownings argument goes something like this. We don't want these unscrupulous, very agile people smugglers who are the, scum of the earth, the lowest of the low. We don't want them getting back into business because they're cruel and unscrupulous and people drown, people die and people drown. But all of history tells us that people seeking asylum perish. Some of them perish. They take a calculated risk. They think it is better to risk my life trying to get to something safe than to stay where I am. Now, what happens if we are serious about the drowning argument? What does it take us? What it takes us is this. We would rather you stay and face down the Taliban than risk your life at sea. Because of the Taliban, you're still dead just as if you drown. Or maybe you escape northwards and cross the Mediterranean. If you drown there, well, you're still dead. But we won't know about it. The drowning argument really just comes to this. We know people die in their attempt to reach safety. But we don't want to know about them dying. We don't want it to happen where we can see it because it's all too painful for us. We would rather they suffer somewhere else. It's a purely selfish, self-interested argument. And frankly, it's not surprising politicians love it. Now, it is in an intentionally cruel system. Second reason why you should care. There are so many examples. Think of Omid Masumali. Omid Masumali, who set himself on fire on Nauru just a few weeks ago. Omid and his family had already been assessed as refugees. There was nowhere they could go because the Nauru is very hostile to the refugees who are there. Nauru will not allow them to settle there indefinitely.
Australia will not allow them to come here, and Australia has rejected offers of New Zealand that they should go there. They've rejected it because the Australians say, oh, that'll just be seen as a backdoor into Australia. So they're stuck. And Omid and his family were so driven to despair at their future prospects that Omid poured petrol on himself and set himself on fire, and he died. And bringing together the drowning's argument with the intentional cruelty with which we're treating people, Kathy Wilcox captured it perfectly. I don't know how many of you saw her cartoon. She was a little cartoon of a man engulfed in flames, and the caption simply read, "Not drowning." We know, of course, that Reza Barati was murdered on Manus Island. I don't know how many people here saw the Four Corners program about Hamid Karzai, who died of septicemia. He cut his foot on Manus Island, and he was treated with such criminal neglect by our immigration department that he was brain dead by the time they decided to move him to Brisbane for medical help. Scott Morrison, who is one of the most dishonest and hypocritical politicians this country has ever seen, Scott Morrison went on air and said that Hamid Karzai was in Brisbane receiving the best medical treatment available. He forgot to add that Hamid Karzai was already brain dead. Let me let you into a small prediction, and my prediction about politics is not worth having, but here we go. I think on the 2nd of July it is possible, perhaps even probable, that the Liberals will get back with a reduced majority. If they get in, it will be with a reduced majority. And a hostile party room will roll up in Turnbull, and we will have Scott Morrison, PM. There's something to dread. There's, I guess, another story that's worth telling about the cruelty. You know, we've had Reza Barati, Hamid Karzai, and Omid Masumali, all of whom died as a direct result of the way we treat them. When challenged with this, I think it was Dutton who said, "These things are regrettable but necessary because they're a deterrent." A deterrent, that is, people chancing around and trying to get here. Well, I suppose if we took a few boat people out into public and executed them, that would be a deterrent. If someone can explain to me the moral difference between those two sets of deaths, I'd be fascinated to hear it. But that is the level to which we've sunk. And if we're concerned about international attitudes to this, just travel overseas and introduce yourself to people as an Australian and hear how people respond to what they know we are doing. We live in a bubble. We're entirely insulated from any awareness of how we're seen overseas. I first got a hint of this in, I think, 2003, when I was in London, and I'm about to show up. I was there to do a Privy Council case from New Zealand. And Geoffrey Robertson took me to a few things. And I think it was the first night I'd arrived, he took me to an international, sort of European lawyers thing. And it took me a while, because I had a jet lag, it took me a while to notice that he introduced me to each person as the Australian barrister who ran the Tampa litigation. And all of them recognised the reference. Think about that. All of them recognised the reference to the Tampa litigation. We are held in such low regard by people in Europe because of the way we are mistreated, deliberately mistreating asylum seekers who get here by boat. So the third argument you should care about the issue is that it is ludicrously expensive. Ludicrously expensive. It's very hard to get reliable figures, but the best estimates I've heard, and this is from coalition sources, is that our detention system onshore and offshore costs about $5 billion a year. Now, that's a big number. Only General Reinhardt understands a number like that. But I've got a new unit of measure for you. It's a million Geelong chopper rides a year. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. And we are doing it with the purpose of deliberately hurting people so as to discourage them from coming and asking for our help. I think it's worth adding here, there is an alternative way of doing it. Because a lot of people say, well, what else can we do? What else can we do? If we're nice to them, we'll be flooded. Well, we've never been flooded before. The biggest arrival rate of uninvited people in little boats was 25,000 in 2012. actually wish if we go back to 1788, we might top that. Mm-hmm. But 25,000 was the biggest number we've ever had in any year in since white settlement. Now, is 25,000 a big number? Well, no, it's not, because we get between 150,000 and 200,000 new permanent migrants each year. So demographically, it's not a big number. How many people do we get coming across our borders each year for, you know, either permanent or more likely temporary purposes like business or tourism? Between 4 and 5 million. We get between 4 and 5 million people coming across our borders each year, almost all of them with visas or Australian passports. And we get a tiny handful who come here without visas, without an invitation. We call them illegals. And those people represent less than half of 1% of the total arrivals. Now, when I was at school, 99.5% of an exam was a good thing. But of course, in the hands of the politicians, it becomes a failure of border control. A failure of border control, unbelievable. 99.5% isn't a failure of border control, it's a demonstration of very effective border control, I should have thought. So, what are the alternatives? Well, first, you have to close down offshore processing. We are simply taking people who've arrived here and taking them by force against their will and shifting them to impoverished countries on the equator. Manus Island, part of Papua New Guinea, north of Port Moresby, and Nauru, an independent republic in the Central Pacific, or South Pacific, I guess. Nauru, bankrupt. Total land area, 21 square kilometres. It's smaller than Tullamarine Airport. Population, 10,000 or fewer. Gross domestic product, immeasurably small. Their source of income is what we give them to warehouse refugees for us to save us the embarrassment, because after all, we'd be overcrowded if they came here. So what's the alternative? Okay, close down offshore processing. Accept that if we stop being brutal to people, then boats will arrive. Okay. Let's pretend that the boat arrival rate, the peak boat arrival rate, 25,000 per year, let's pretend that becomes a new normal. And let's pretend that every single one of them spends all their time in Australia on Centrelink benefits. Let's see how that plays out. So I would say if they arrive, first of all, you put them in detention initially. I don't have a problem with that. I'm not advocating open borders. Detention capped at 1 month. And use that month for preliminary health and security checks. And at the end of 1 month, release them into the community. And their visa will have at least four major conditions. First is they must stay in touch with the department by regularly reporting to post offices, for example. Second, they're allowed to work, even if they're immigrant in their own language. Third, they are allowed full access to Centrelink and Medicare benefits. And fourth, until their refugee status is finally decided, they must live in a specified rural town or city. Now let's pretend that 25,000 is the new normal. Let's pretend that every single one of them stays on full Centrelink benefits. These are very unlikely assumptions, but make them. That would cost the federal economy $500 million a year. Now, all of that would be spent in the economies of rural towns and cities, so that would be good for them. But $500 million a year to help the rural economy and be decent to human beings who are just looking for safety seems to be better than $5,000 million to be cruel to them and damage our national character at the same time. So if you want some courage, let's all unite and advocate a different and better way of treating people who come here looking for protection. There's one other thing I want to add, two other things I want to add. One, what we are doing is grotesquely at odds with the Australian character, and the government has just worked that out. And so they passed the Australian Border Force Act last year. The Australian Border Force Act, amongst other things, makes it the Australian Border Force Act makes it a criminal offence for anyone working in the detention system to disclose anything they learn while working in the detention system. So, for example, in civil society, it's a criminal offence for a doctor to be aware of a case of child sex abuse But if the same doctor is aware of a case of child sex abuse in the detention system, it's a criminal offence for them to report it. You know, I mean, it's crazy. And when there's a crime to report a crime, you know the joint's being run by criminals. The other thing I want to mention is this. I didn't want to mention politicians again, but a lot of people have been asking me, what can we do in this election? Well, I'll tell you, I'll be blunt about it, and I'm not an adherent of any political party, but I will say the best thing this time is vote Green, number one, and then your second vote to whoever you would have voted for in any event. The reason for this is simple. I don't think either of the major parties are listening to any of us. They're looking at where the votes are. They will notice a drop in their primary vote. I think it's fairly reasonable to say the Greens are not going to form a government, but if the major parties both get the message that they are both on the nose, then that will maybe lead to a change in the way they disfigure this country's reputation, a reputation we could have once been proud of, but one which has been progressively trashed since the 11th of September 2001. Thank you.